Good evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, along with Mel, K2 KEY. We gather the clan, and we run a thing called SecNet. And it's basically a group of guys coming together, teaching each other the fine points of ham radio and their equipment and how to get the most fun out of it and how to get the most performance out of it. We teach each other. Education is the main thing that happens. Occasionally a little bit of entertainment sneaks in, but that's not our main purpose. The subjects that are discussed on the TechNet are primarily the subjects you guys bring to the TechNet. So it's your show. Once in a while, Mel will have a prepared program on a particular subject, like how does decibels work, or how does the Smith chart work, or how do you do impedance matching. But for the most part, it's your questions. Quite possibly we'll hear from Joe today, W-A-2-R-Y-Y, who's been doing an investigation of a power supply. And one of the things that I learned after 35 years of service at a company called Airborne Instruments Laboratory is that everybody thinks power is boring, and a power supply is boring. But when it comes to real high-performance equipment, very vital equipment, the most common point of failure is the power supply. You can have a gold-plated transmitter, a silver-plated receiver, and a platinum-covered antenna. If the power supply fails, you're off the air. So good, reliable power supplies are extremely important. And it's not a boring subject. Very similar to what I've discovered in the past a couple of months. People think that a dipole antenna and impedance matching it is a boring subject. And there's a lot more to it than meets the eye in all cases. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Typical sign-in would sound like this, W-A-2-R-Y-Y, Joe and yes. Do we have any check-ins tonight? Give me a call letters and name at this time.
Julio, Rich and yes.
Okay, Rich recognized. Anyone else?
AC2AE, Joe. And no, just listening.
No. Okay, a pair of no's.
A-Y-Y. Joe. Yes.
Okay, a couple of no's. Joe with a yes. Anyone else?
KB1NNH, Jerry, no.
Jerry with a no. Anyone else?
Kilo, Charlie 2, Uniform, Papa, Papa, Mike, no.
Good evening all, K2KEY.
KC2MDP, Steve, no questions.
KC2ULP, Dick, I don't know if you got my sign. It's Bill and Mel.
Yeah, we did, Bill. John, Kilo Bravo 2, Bravo Delta, I'm hearing you on the input, but I'm not hearing you coming through the machine. So maybe you don't have your PL tuned to 136.5. So Kilo, Bravo 2, Bravo Delta. John's recorded, but let's see if John can come through. Yeah, once again, Joe, I'm hearing you on the input, but not hearing you coming through the machine at all. So it's going to be a little bit difficult to hold that conversation. But John, as we've heard from previous conversations, is one of these people who has gotten pretty deep into extremely high frequency measurement and frequency accuracy and high spectral purity oscillators. One last call. Anyone else to chime in, sign into the TechNet? Who's got a question or a comment? Give me your call letters, your name, and the yes at this time. Okay, the first person who signed in was Rich. And what's happening with Whitestone in a booming, in a real nice community of Whitestone? What's happening there, Rich?
Okay, good evening, everybody. M2EO. Hello, Dick. And as usual, believe it or not, the cat came in here when he heard your voice. He's sitting here with me. Dick, I have a question about HF propagation tonight. You had mentioned a couple of weeks ago that, I forget what you called it, a water below, something like that. You said that back around 1915 to 1930, I think you said, we were hearing a low on sunspot activity. I wonder how you pronounce that. Mortimer low. Are we in that again? Because I know in September, this past September, they reported there was no sunspots for that month. Today I was on 20 meters trying to check into the Collins net, and there was just no propagation. Only thing I heard was DE7 coming in from northwestern Canada and 1W0, and the man was totally dead. So what's the story, Dick? What is the current feeling thought by the experts? Are we going to skip this particular sunspot cycle or what? K2RIW is a TechNet at 2EO.
Okay, what I may have mentioned then is the so-called Maunder minimum, M-A-U-N-D-E-R minimum. The most classic, well, first of all, sunspots have been tracked by mankind since the early Chinese writings. So thousands of years, we've got a slightly discontinuous record of sunspots. And everything since around 1600, that record became more and more complete. But from roughly 1600 to 1650 to 1700, there's a 50-year period in which there appears to have been no sunspots at all. And so, the best thinking right now, and there's been other minimums, but that was the most classic, long, deep minimum. The sun has got an 11-year cycle or a 20-year, 2-year cycle, depending on how you look at it. In other words, every 11 years, the sunspot cycle goes through a minimum and a maximum, and it reverses polarity between alternate minimums. So we got a positive polarity on the magnetic field out of the sun for one 11-year period, and the negative polarity out of the sun for the next 11-year period. So some people think when you're looking for tree ring research and investigating sunspot cycles, that you shouldn't look for an 11-year cyclicity, you should look for a 22, because they believe certain weather patterns repeat in 22 years. So the sun has got this 11-year or 22-year cycle, and it has other cycles of longer durations. And so, do we have the complete story on the sun? No. I found a website that'll give you a lot of information about the current state of solar research, and there's a lot to be learned there. It is by far the most important thing you and I care about. Let me drop. That sun, at this instant of time, is putting out something like 10 to the 27 watts. In other words, one, or maybe it's four, with 27 zeros after it, is the number of watts it puts out, second by second, day by day, year by year, century by century. And it's an extremely constant number. It varies a little bit, but not very much. And by the time you back away 93 million miles to where you and I are living, we're getting 1,380 watts per square meter hitting the surface of the sun, of the Earth. And it powers everything. Just about anything you can think of on Earth, any energy source you look at, petroleum, coal, gas, whatever, you're looking at past solar events of some kind of a living organism that died, decayed, left that material that gives us a fuel. So you're looking at past solar events on everything we use. And so it's awful important. When you go to a Google search on the word Maunder minimum, M-A-U-N-D-E-R, and you look at Wikipedia, you'll get quite a bit of information, and there's a lot of other websites on the subject. Maybe this is or is not the one that you're referring to right now, Rich. N2EL for some further information, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, K2RIW, N2EL. Yeah, I was wondering what the current feeling is. Are we going to skip this particular cycle, because it's been about 2 years that we've been dwelling in this minimum, and the man has just been in terrible shape.
And it turns out that the microwave enthusiasts are also complaining about that. The website for the microwave reflector of WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha, has this microwave reflector listserv with about 300 very serious microwaves worldwide, sending information back and forth between them. And when it comes to the tropospheric and extended ground wave and other kinds of band openings for the microwave frequencies for the last 2 years, those guys are complaining. And so the sunspots and the number of sunspots has a lot to do with what the status of the ionosphere is. And for the people who are on 3 to 30 megacycles, the state of the ionosphere is everything. Because try to talk to your buddy on 20 meters who lives 50 miles away during the time that the ionosphere is not there, and it's a very difficult contact. A VHF person can do it. A person on 20 meters will have great difficulty if there isn't an ionosphere to reflect that signal off of. That band is a lot more noisy, so therefore just the direct signal is not enough. The so-called reflection, and it's more complicated than a reflection, but the reflection you get off of that ionosphere is like a mirror that gives you an extremely strong bounced signal over that horizon and allows the other guy you want to talk to get a lot more signal strength than you would ordinarily get. So, this particular minimum, is it really going to be another one of these Maunder minimums? The majority of people think no. It's not a 50-year minimum of essentially no sunspots. The majority think no. There have been other periods of low number of sunspots for an extended period of time. They do see evidence from time to time that the next cycle maybe is starting to come alive, but it certainly is delayed. I'd like to know if anyone around here has further information on what the next sunspot cycle is predicted to be. But before I throw it open to that question, let's see what Mel wants to tell us about all this. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, I get weekly reports. K7RA out in Oregon, he keeps a constant blog on this, I guess you could call it, from NOAA. Now, the latest report that I just got in this week was that cycle 24 has really showed no real sign. There was some promising couple sunspots did show up a few weeks ago, and the count went to, I think, 11, but it slowly died off. The way, of course, they determine it, because the sunspots, the new sunspots, have the opposite polarity of the ones previous. So cycle 24, they showed some sign, but it didn't seem to materialize. Now, as far as the propagation goes right now, it is strange, because today I looked around after we had the 10-meter net this morning. We just have a group of us here to get together, mostly from the club here in Brooklyn. But, of course, anybody would like to join us Sunday morning, 11 o'clock, 28.380. We are there, and just keep 10 meters alive. Let me let it drop for a minute. Okay, now, I did look around and I saw 20, not too great. However, when I was surprised, I usually work my way from 10, 15, 20. You know, I work my way through the band. I got to 30 meters and I was surprised. I could hear signals on 30 meters. They were somewhat weak, but they started to build up. So I took another look this afternoon and sure enough, lots of Europeans coming through, some Asia was coming through on 30 meters. Now, the other band seems to be wide dead. This is something very unusual is happening. And you'll find this happens sporadically. 160 is alive, the rest are dead. And it seems that it's no rhyme or reason for what is happening at this point. Whether we are entering a Maunder minimum, we will know, they said, by the fall of the year. We have now so far 590 days almost with no sunspots to speak of. This is where it stands right now, Dick. Over.
Yeah, there's been a couple of articles on this one on spaceweather.com and a few other places. And there have been minimum periods around the 1905 or 1910 period, nowhere near as deep as the Maunder minimum. And the Maunder minimum, by the way, was detected in the 1800s, even though it occurred in the 1600s. An astronomer named Maunder recognized the fact that the records were not just lacking, there really was very few sunspots during that period of time. Very complicated phenomena going on with the sun. And if you go to a website I could recommend to you, I haven't got the... yes, I could. I could give you the email address where you could read what is now known about the mechanisms by which the sun works. The majority of what the sun does is to use hydrogen fusion to fuse hydrogen molecules, four hydrogen molecules in a multi-step process into one single helium molecule. Tremendous amounts of energy are given off when it does that. The sun is essentially 80% hydrogen right now, 20% helium right now, and everything else is just a trace gas. It is slowly converting hydrogen into helium. It's going to do that process for approximately 10 billion years, and we're 4.5 billion years into that cycle. So there's still some time left. But the procedures by which it does it, there is no solid surface to the sun. It's one great big, very hot gas ball with a whole lot of complicated phenomena going on from the inner layers to all the outer layers. And the magnetic fields that are controlling that plasma, by the way, on Earth, plasma is a very rare substance. You know, a conductive gas is a plasma. On Earth, it's very rare. In space, it's there's more plasma than anything else. Every single star really is a plasma, a conducting gas. The temperatures are so high that the electrons and the nucleuses of every molecule are essentially separated from each other. So that magnetic field on the sun has a lot to do with the sunspots. And why does it move in certain ways? Why does the sun rotate the way it does? The equator of the sun rotates once in 25 days, and the north and south pole of the sun rotates once in 30 days. So it's got this differential rotation.
Repeater, time out.
It's got that differential rotation that takes that magnetic field being generated inside and winds it up like a watch spring, and every so often that that wound up magnetic field snaps and starts all over again, and that's the beginning of the next 11-year cycle. That is a theory by some people, and maybe it's got some merit, and maybe it explains some of the phenomena, but there's still an awful lot unknown. I'm convinced, Rich, that the sunspots will come back. Now, the next question is going to be, are they going to come back in a month, a year, or a decade? And we have no choice but to wait and see. Now, of anyone out there who's got further information on sunspots, when they're going to come back, and whatever, let's give a nice long delay, including a complete dropout of the machine, in case someone's out there on IRLP, internet, whatever, Echo Link, and wants to join us and has some sparks to give on this subject. As you can tell, I don't know a heck of a lot about it. So we're going to take sign-ins at this time. KQRIW, listening.
I'll make one more comment when you get a chance. Let's take a listen first.
AC2AE with a comment.
WO2N. Okay, I heard KC2AE and an extremely weak WO2N. KC2AE, start off with your name, sir, and then your comment.
I'm sorry, Dick. It's AC2, Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Echo. I was just commenting. I don't know if I should go on with the comment or not yet, but my name is Joe.
Yes, go right ahead with your comment, Joe.
Well, I believe that the solar cycle is a little slow right now. I think there's other things in play that's going on with the Earth that's actually slowing it down. Our magnetic poles are in what you would say a state of flux right now, which are about to change. I don't know if anyone out there has heard anything about it or has read anything about it, but they've been doing some tests and some studies, and the magnesites in our soil and stuff is at its weakest point that it's been in over I think it was 700 or something years. I think that has something to do with it. You know, I could be totally way off on that. You know, I'm no scientist or a physicist. But by any chance, I think that might have something to do with it. If anybody has any comments on that or any feedback or any factual statement to that, I would be greatly appreciated to hear it. Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Echo. Back to you, Dick.
This is K2KEY, Dick.
Well recognized. And thank you, Joe, for your comment. And that is, without a doubt, the Earth's magnetic field has reversed a large number of times in our history. And are we about to go to another one of those reversals? And if so, life could get a little bit complicated. I'd like to believe when the magnetic field that the Earth reverses, it does it by having the North Pole and the South Pole of our magnetic field simply propagating from one location to another. And it does wander around. If the magnetic field reverses by going through zero and then coming back to life in the opposite polarity, like a sine wave of Con Ed power, that would worry me. Because without a magnetic field, the solar wind would not be deflected by the Van Allen belt and give you the aurora borealis and aurora australis. You would have a slow peeling away of the atmosphere. It is believed, for instance, that Mars had a much better atmosphere than it has right now, but because Mars has no magnetic field, it is unable to hold on to its atmosphere. Let's see what Mel should say about all this. K2KEY, when's the next sun's five cycle going to come back, Mel? Does your crystal ball tell you? K2RIW.
Well, I'll tell you basically what the scientists now of, with the government, with, you know, NOAA, have more or less come to the conclusion that if we do not see the beginning of a new cycle 24 by the fall of the year, most likely right after the summer sometime, that means that we most likely have entered some kind of water minimum. Now, how severe a water minimum? You know, there's all kinds of water minimum lengths of time that can occur. The longest I could say was from 1650 to 17, about 25. The consensus is that if you do have a new cycle beginning, it will be a shorter cycle and will never get up anywhere, you know, as high as we've seen in the past. Of course, around 1960, that cycle was unusual, was the highest ever recorded in hundreds and hundreds of years when the solar count sunspots had peaked at one time to over, I think, 220 or so. So the point is right now that we don't know, you know, until about, like I say, within about 6 months exactly how we stand, but this will be the benchmark, what happens. Now, as far as the reversal of the magnetic field, the Earth, it has, as you said, happened many times. They have been able to, you know, look at certain rocks and things that were able to indicate that. But it seems like that when the reversal took place, it most likely still provided with the Earth with enough shielding so that we did not, like you say, like Mars, if Mars did have that water, like they assume, that we weren't, you know, didn't get blown off the surface of the Earth like it did at Mars, what it went through, most likely may have been similar to the Earth at one time, Dick, over.
Yeah, thank goodness we've got a magnetic field. We've got a molten core, and it's believed that the churning of that molten core at the center of the Earth is where our magnetic field is coming from. One belief is that Mars has cooled off enough, doesn't have a molten core anymore, no longer generating a magnetic field, and that's one of the major reasons it lost its atmosphere. Another reason is Mars is considerably smaller in diameter than the Earth. So how well you can hold on to your atmosphere is a function of having enough size, enough gravity, and enough magnetic field. Mel has referred to NOAA a couple of times, NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, a government agency assigned to study such things, to study our atmosphere and oceans and weather, and they do a pretty good job. And some of the satellites they put up, like, for instance, the SOHO satellite, I think they have some responsibility for SOHO. That's that satellite that is a million miles closer to the sun than we are. We're 93 million miles out, and it's at one of those Lagrange points, one of those stable points or quasi-stable points. And so being a million miles ahead on the sun side of the Earth as the Earth goes around, it's in orbit around the sun just like we are, but it's a smaller orbit than one of those stable points. So it gives us forewarning. It allows us to 24 hours a day really see the status of the sun at many different wavelengths. So if you go to the SOHO website and look at some of those photographs of past events and current events, some pretty exciting material. A real modern-day, let me drop, a modern-day solar research got its vast beginning with the Skylab project, where quite a few instruments were flown on board, manned by the astronauts who studied the sun at ultraviolet and other frequencies and saw a number of phenomena that had never been seen before. So the real beginning of modern-day solar research possibly was the Skylab project, which was in the late 70s, middle 70s, I think, is when the Skylab project was running. Anybody with any further questions or comments, give me a call. That is right now on the subject of the sunspot cycle.
WO2N.
Okay, WO2N. You sound a lot better now. Wonder what change you made. Give me your name and go ahead with your comment.
Okay, good evening to the net. And, well, I was trying to get into 850 with 5 watts. I'm about 70 miles east of you. I was using 5 watts going to 850, but I switched to the East Link now and up the power. And I'm running off the side of my 4L and Yagi, so I'm coming in good. I just wanted to say, if you look at this week's Ohio Penn DX bulletin, because I follow the DX and been knowing it for 25 years, so... What I can tell you is there's a little article in there in the OPDX with a web link also, and their prediction, NOAA's prediction, they're predicting that solar cycle 24 will peak in May of 2013. So they're basing it on an 11-year cycle, which I always believed it was 11 years. But anyway, they're saying that the thing is that 23 lasted abnormally long. And they're saying here that it ended in December of 08. So the start of 24 should be going, but it's probably going to be a little shorter and maybe weaker. But they're predicting 24 to be the weakest cycle since number 16, which peaked at 78 daily sunspots in 1928. And the ninth week is since 1750, when number cycles began. So, enjoy the low bands anyway. 160 and 80 is all I can say. But they're saying that 24 has started now, and it's going to be a short cycle, and 23 was abnormally long, maybe with a double bottom that we've probably been seeing here for the last couple of years. But Ohio Penn DX this week... see if it has a number. Number 908, Ohio Penn number 908, and that's the Ohio Penn DX, a group out there in Ohio. And you can get it off the internet. And then they have a link, which I didn't check, but they have an article from NOAA Weather, Dick. And that's their opinion on it. WO2N, back to net.
Hi, thank you, Bernie. Good information. Bernie's in Mastic, New York, and I'm guessing Mastic is, what, a healthy 60 miles east of New York City. That's why he's coming through the eastern input, the 147.375 machine, as opposed to the 146.85, and the two are linked together with a computer network and IRLP done by KE2EJ and WA2CDL, who maintain those machines for us. Okay, so... Ohio Penn DX and article number 908 is going to give us a lot more information for those who are interested. Good information, Bernie, and thank you. Okay, I'm going to move on to Joe. Joe has been troubleshooting a very pesky power supply. He's got a pair of power supplies, I think it's a Motorola setup, an older piece of equipment, where there's something like a 300-volt power supply and another 450-volt power supply, and the two of them are put in series so that you get 300 volts and something like 800 volts out of this combination. And the 300-volt portion and the 800 and the 400-and-some-odd-volt portion are essentially identical in schematic diagram, except that one of them is floating on top of the other, so that you've got the two different high voltages for this particular tube transmitter setup of a Motorola repeater that he's maintaining. And the upper power supply, the one that's supposed to produce 400 and a fraction volts, 400 and some odd volts, does produce the 400 and some odd volts when it's unloaded, but loaded it jumps down to something like 200. And so Joe had replaced the bridge rectifier assembly, the series diode assembly, the filter capacitors. He had replaced essentially everything and was measuring the voltage coming out of the secondary winding of the transformer. It seemed to be hunky-dory, and yet the power supply had this peculiar characteristic. And finally, in desperation, one of the things Joe did was to short out the filter choke. It's a PI output filter network, which means you've got the bridge rectifier, a capacitor to ground, a series inductor of approximately 5 Henrys, another capacitor to ground, and then the output. It's supposed to be a PI-type filter network. He had already replaced those capacitors, and alt
repeater, timeout.
Only when Joe put a clip lead across the 5 Henry choke did the power supply come back to seemingly normal operation under full load. So Joe replaced that inductor, the 5 Henry inductor, with another one from another spare power supply, and now everything's hunky-dory, and he wanted to know what's wrong with the old inductor. It's supposed to measure 75 ohms. It measures 74 and a fraction ohms. Very, very close. And then Joe and I have had a number of emails back and forth as to, without a whole lot of fancy laboratory equipment, how do you measure how many Henrys a choke has? And one of the suggestions I made to Joe was to take something like a 6.3-volt filament transformer. He used an 18-volt transformer. Put 60 cycles into the choke and measure how much AC current it generates. The inductive reactance is equals 2 pi FL. And that gives you an answer in ohms of inductive reactance, and you plug in 60 cycles, and you end up with a number like 1,800 ohms. The choke should have 1,800 ohms of reactance at 60 cycles if it was approximately 5 Henry. And so I think Joe has actually proceeded with some of those measurements, and maybe he's going to tell us what he's discovered. W2RYY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick, and the TechNet, W2RY here. Yeah, I did some tests. I did some tests to try to determine the reactance of the choke using the K2RIW method of measuring current here. And actually, I was very surprised at my readings here. I did use an 18-volt AC supply, and I used a series resistor of 33.3 ohms, so I couldn't have a 100-ohm resistor laying around. And I got a small voltage drop across the resistor, and determine the current in the whole circuit. So let's see, something like a little over 3 mils of current. It's actually 0.003273273 for like an exact answer. With the volt, subtracting the voltage drop across the resistor, that told me the voltage across the choke should have been 18.271 because I was reading with 18.380 volts of AC according to my digital voltmeter. That led me to believe that, with formulation, that the apparent resistance of that choke was about 5,581 ohms and change. And if you work that backwards, at 60 hertz, that looks like a choke that has an inductance of 14 Henrys. And I can't understand why the thing would go from 5 Henrys up to 14 Henrys. And apparently this choke is bad, because when I changed it with another supply, from another power supply of a similar design, it immediately solved the problem. I got the correct DC voltages out, and the voltage was going unloaded from about 440 volts to about 280 under load. Now the voltage goes from, say, unloaded about 475 volts, it goes down about 410, 415 or so. So now it's well within range of where it's supposed to be. Using the same method with the choke, I measured the thing on DC and come up with a reading of, 33.3 ohms, 4.3 volts across the resistor for the drop. I got 9.74 across the choke. Something like 0.129 amps, 129 milliamps or so for series current. And that told me the resistance of the choke was about 75.253 ohms and change. So the DC resistance seemed to be correct and very close to what the manufacturer stated in the specifications for the choke. They said they stated 80 ohms, a nominal DC resistance. But my question is, Dick, okay, and I previously told you that the power supply was subjected to a water cement type of spray because other people working in the building that were having a repeater transmitter, and they saturated the thing pretty good, and a lot of this water spray got in the cabinet, some of it got on the back of the power supply, and some other components also. But I'm not sure if this by itself made the choke change the apparent inductance. Have you ever seen something like this happen before, Dick? K2RAW, W-A-2-L-A-Y.
Yeah, there's still a bit of a mystery here. When Joe measured the inductance by measuring AC current that flows through it, when he puts roughly 18 volts AC at 60 cycles across the choke, and how much inductive reactance it has will show up by how many milliamperes of AC current is flowing when you put the 18 volts on it. And with the 33 ohm sensing resistor, the 100 ohm resistor I suggested was just a nominal value, 33 ohms, as long as you know it's in the vicinity of 33 ohms, is a perfectly good value. 1 ohm would have worked also nicely if you got a sensitive enough meter. And some of our VOMs and digital voltmeters also have an AC ampere scale, which could have been used directly instead of the resistor. The resistor is a little bit safer because if there's some kind of a momentary short circuit inside the choke, and you've got an 18-volt transformer feeding the choke, and it makes a short circuit, the instantaneous current on your milliammeter, which maybe is a digital voltmeter, a Simpson, a triplet, or whatever, it could blow its fuse. It could be damaged if you exceed a certain amount of current. So using the resistor is a safer approach. That's part of why I suggested that. But now there's still a bit of a mystery. Let me drop. The whole idea of a PI filter network is that the first filter capacitor to ground after the bridge rectifier gives you medium good filtering. In other words, under load, you're going to get approximately the right DC voltage, but there's going to be a moderate amount of ripple there. And you could, if you want to, put an infinite number of microfarads, and the ripple would go away. But then you have some spooky startup characteristics, and putting an infinite number of microfarads on a power supply that's going to fit in the same room with you is kind of difficult. So back in the old days when people were inventing power supplies, they discovered that a PI filter network gives you the best combination of reasonable size of components and yet a rather small amount of ripple voltage. So by having the first set of filter capacitors do a medium job of ripple filter, the choke has some inductance that goes into a second set of capacitors, the output capacitors of the PI network, and that does the rest of the job of filtering. And so a good PI filter output network in Joe's environment might have only a volt or so of ripple out of 400 and some odd volts, and that's a very desirable power supply. As that filter choke goes to a larger and larger number of Henrys of inductance, it should do a better and better job of filtering, meaning that no ripple comes out, and as long as the DC voltage drop is small and it's only got 75 ohms of series resistance, then there shouldn't be very much average voltage drop, just ripple elimination. So making the choke go to infinity should be very desirable, as long as it doesn't run into some kind of a resonance phenomenon. You've got to be a little bit careful with the values of chokes and capacitors, because if you happen to hit 60 cycle resonance in that network, then it's really a PI output a tank circuit for a transmitter, so to speak, and your transformer and bridge rectifier is supplying the signal. See, you got to be careful you don't hit resonance. Very few people do. So other than hitting a resonance phenomenon, making the choke too big should be big. It should be okay. And I guess we got to make a quick calculation on that. So what Joe measured is that a choke that is supposed to be 5 Henry, when unloaded with DC current, appears to be 14 Henry. A little bit mysterious. I mean, because how would you make a choke have more Henrys, more inductance? You'd give it more turns?
Repeater, time out.
You'd give it more turns of its wire. You'd put a bigger iron core through it. Well, just because it got sprayed with water and a cement mixture because some construction was going on in the building where his repeater was located, that in itself doesn't explain an extreme increase in inductance. An inductance increase by itself shouldn't be bad. So there's a bit of a mystery here. The next step in the process is Joe put real current through it and measured that it's got 75 ohms. His ohmmeter said 75 ohms. He put some real current through it, and again he got 75 ohms, or approximately that number. So that doesn't explain it. The third thing to do, and this is a more difficult thing, is to try to put the choke under real working conditions. Under real working conditions, the load current flows through the choke. In other words, if his power supply is supplying a tube with a quarter of an ampere of 800 volts, that quarter of an ampere must flow through the choke. When a choke has, in my example, a quarter of an ampere flowing through it, the average choke will have a little bit of saturation of its core, and therefore the inductance that you measure under current conditions will be a little bit lower. Many chokes will have an intentional gap that's filed into the core somewhere in the way they assemble the EI laminations so as to minimize the amount of saturation characteristics. So, as I said, the choke becoming too big could be a false positive measurement because we're not putting current through it. And even if it did get to a larger number of Henrys, as long as you don't run into some kind of a resonance phenomenon at 120 cycles, that doesn't explain it. So it's a very good mystery novel we got going here, Joe. You've got a lot more information. We've all becoming a little bit more educated about power supplies. We haven't quite got to the bottom of it yet, assuming there is a bottom somewhere here. Joe being a curious guy and a kind of a scientist, I guarantee he's going to keep searching. He may discontinue the project temporarily because something else of higher priority comes along in his life, but someday he's going to find out what happened to this poor choke and why when he replaces it. I mean, what we've measured so far, what Joe has measured so far, doesn't
meter, transmit.
What Joe has measured so far doesn't completely explain the partial failure of this power supply. Let me pass it over to the net to see if anyone has any further comments on this. And if need be, try to let the machine thoroughly drop and become silent for a couple of seconds in case someone out of the area wants to sign in and give us more information. K2RIW in the TechNet, listen for any other sign-ins.
Until we need information, we'll let it drop.
KB2HWW with a comment on this subject.
And KC2QIQ.
Okay, we've got Rich, Howie, and Glenn. Is there anyone else? Okay, Rich is the one I heard first. What's your comment on this one, Rich?
Dick, anybody in there? Yeah, I recently had a similar situation, and it was weird, on a Collins power supply, which, of course, is two rectifiers, but it applies. I was running into a situation where, again, I had very, very low voltage on an 800-volt supply to supply the plate of the final tube. And when I jumped out the filter choke, the choke input power supply, the voltage came up a little higher than normal. Not much, a little bit higher than normal. You would put the choke back in line, the voltage would just die. And someone else looked at it, and neither of us could figure it out. Anyway, what it turned out to be, I later found it, tube sockets, some ceramic sockets, and I miswired one of the sockets. And instead of having the output coming off the cathode, it was a full-wave sensor tap supply. And instead of having both cathodes connected, Only one was connected. I inadvertently moved over one pin on the tube socket, so it was running as a half wave supply, not a full wave supply. And that was my problem. I wonder, in his case, I'm sure he's not using two rectifiers, but somehow if there could be a bad diode in the bridge and something, again, running as a half wave supply. Back to that at 2EO.
Yeah, where you had a miswiring of those ceramic sockets and your rectifier tubes, 866s or whatever they were, 3B28s, when one of the tubes is not there, your full rectification, full-wave rectification is not there. Half-wave rectification really gives you a pulse of current on every other half-cycle of the 60 cycles, and so if the choke is big enough, the voltage going into the choke literally follows the voltage coming out of the transformer, so to speak, and the DC value goes to very, very low numbers under load. So a choke input supply is very vulnerable to that. But Joe's case is a PI network. It's a capacitor to ground, choke, another capacitor to ground. And he's using a bridge rectifier. Unfortunately, he doesn't own a scope right now. If he did, it'd be nice to see that it's a normal 120 cycle pulsating DC voltage waveform coming out of that bridge rectifier. It'd be nice to see that waveform. But there's still a bit of a mystery, as you can tell. Let's see if Howie's got an answer to this. Those guys from Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, they've worked on power supplies from way back, and sometimes they know something. You got it, Howie. K2LAW.
I'm going to go in the same direction as you are, Dick. With the power supply operational, I would have put a little series resistor in line with the power, with the choke, and then I would have measured the phase angle of the choke. I measured it with a scope, with a tool tray scope, and I want to know if the phase angle is going to change between load and no load to see if that choke somehow is changing inductance and acting like a swinging choke or something. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, another very nice science experiment, Howie. Assuming that he's got a dual trace oscilloscope or an XY function on his oscilloscope. Right now, Joe does not have access to an oscilloscope, so that's a rather difficult measurement. Yes, it can be done if you're real smart with making various combinations of voltage drops across the resistor, across the choke, and across the transformer, and use some complex mathematics. You can come up with some approximations as to what the phase angle is. Very difficult. And when it comes to the subject of phase, the average engineer, and certainly many, many hands, have a lot of trouble with the word phase and phase shift. If you talk about a power factor of a power supply system, and you say that the power factor is 90% because it's an inductive input load to Con Ed, those words roll off the tongue very easily. The number of engineers and the number of amateurs who know what that means and how to correct it and what phase angle measurements means, a little bit of a difficulty. And maybe Mel and I and others should discuss the subject of phase angle measurement and what all it means. Bode plots, let me drop. Whenever you plot the frequency response of any kind of a network, whether it be a filter network, whether it be an audio filter, whether it be a RF filter, whether it be the interstage coupling of an IF strip of a radio or the driver stage of a transmitter, when it comes to plotting frequency response versus frequency, a swept frequency response, the so-called Bode plot, B-O-D-E, or Bode plot, something people pronounce it. It's a plot of amplitude versus frequency on a logarithmic scale. Decibels is the vertical axis, and logarithm of frequency is the horizontal axis. Those plots, properly done, give you a lot of hidden information as to what's going on, particularly with a phase-lock loop system. A good Bode plot, or the equivalent in various other kinds of mathematics, will tell you immediately how much stability, how much phase margin, and whatever you've got for your phase lock loop system, whether or not it's going to go into an undesired oscillation of its loop network. So there's a whole lot of learning we could all do when it comes to phase measurements and filter characteristics. There are people who spend quite a few hours of class time studying those subjects in an engineering college. And so, is it appropriate for this net? Maybe, but we'll have to go in doses because some people don't want it all at once, if you know what I mean. But the guy who's got that all figured out is Glenn, KC2QIQ. Hey, Glenn, what's going on here? KQRIW in the Tech Net. Yeah, let me let Glenn talk first, and then I'll come back to you, Howie. Go ahead, Glenn.
Hey, good evening, Dick. Good evening, Joe, and the net. Just two quick comments for me. One is that all inductors in general will, as you apply DC load current through the inductance is going to drop a certain amount. Now, how much it drops really depends on the design of the inductor and the inductor type, because basically all of these inductors that use cores on the outside basically have increased permeability because of the core. And the term for permeability is mu. And how that really comes about is basically the B field over the H field, or B over H, over the H field is what determines mu. And H, as you put current through the inductor, H is going to increase, so there again, just being B over H, as H increases, the mu is going to drop, and the inductance will drop a little bit. There again, depending on it. So that's not all that unusual, as you put current into an inductor, and the inductor swings a little bit. How much? It usually depends on, as you said, Dick, the gap or whatever. But what's more interesting about this is that with a Pi filter and inductance, and seeing the output voltage drop something like 50%, as Joe had experienced, leads me to believe that there's something else going on here. And what I would probably look at is, if this is one of those big laminate type of inductors that go in these big AC power supplies running on 60 cycles, it's probably somehow mechanically mounted down to like a metal chassis someplace. And a good experiment to make is to measure the resistance between the floating inductor, in which you have the two inductor leads, the input and the output lead of the inductor, and the case itself, and see if there's a high pot problem. Is it breaking down? Because if you start getting a leakage current between the inductor and the chassis, you can get some bleed-off currents, and that could cause an actually like a strange loading condition on the power supply and drop the voltage dramatically. But that's something you may want to, another measurement you might want to make, is just resistance between the inductor and the chassis mounting. KC2QIQ, back over to you, Dick.
We've done exactly that. Joe has measured multiple megohms of leakage resistance between winding and core. And he did it at 800 volts. He measured that at 800 volts, a fraction of a microamp flows from that winding to the core. That was one of my first suspicions, because where this inductor has been doused with water and a cement mixture, somebody was using some kind of a water drill, and a watery cement mixture was dripping down on his poor repeater, and some of it dripping into the power supply. So leakage of the core, because it experienced water and rusting and expanding of the core and whatever, and breakdowns of various kinds. That was one of Joe's and my early suspicions. That appears to have not been it. And even if there was a mysterious leakage, he wouldn't get near normal voltage out of the power supply when it's not loaded. But when he puts a clip lead across the choke, and the choke is still in the circuit, he gets normal output voltage. So there's still a bit of a mystery. Howie and then Rich in that order are going to give us some further comments. Howie, go right ahead.
Here's a Professor Seifert would be very happy when you're talking about Foley plots, because that was his main interest. Foley plots when it came to operational amplifiers. But getting back to our subject, yeah, you would want to, my idea of measuring the phase angle, you want to see if the phase angle is changing under load. And if it is, that tells you that that something is going on with the inductor, and maybe somehow the field at the time was affecting to the transformer, magnetically coupling. So all I'm just saying is, if you measure the phase angle and see if the phase angle, a pure inductor is going to be 90 degrees, and it may change. So you want to see how each component is reacting and change, and check the phase angle across the various components, Dick, and see if they change dramatically depending on the load current. Back to you.
Yeah, KC2QIQ with comment.
KC2QIQ with one more comment.
We got Rich, Mel, and Glenn in that order lined up right now. Yeah, if there was a 1-ohm resistor in series with the inductor, which is easy to add, and if you've got a dual trace oscilloscope, where even though the power supply itself is sitting way up above ground. This is the high voltage power supply that's in series with another 300 volt power supply. If you've got high enough voltage probes, and if you're running the scope in the A minus B mode, each one of those probes could be in various places in the circuit, and you measure the differential voltage as if the whole scope was floating. You don't want to float a scope 300 volts above ground and still connect the wiring to Con Ed or Loco and have the case of the scope 300 volts above ground. Very dangerous maneuver. But there's ways you can do that with a dual trace scope if it's got an A minus B function. Also, Triplett and Simpson meters are very well insulated in that case, so the fact that the whole Don volt-ohm milliammeter is sitting up above ground when you make a measurement. So there's various ways that this can be done, but you got to be careful. And the interpretation of phase shift measurements without oscilloscope traces on the so-called 120 cycle full-wave rectified voltage waveform and the way it walks through the circuit. Beautiful science experiment. You probably could do a bachelor final report on that in college, and it would be extremely well accepted. Master's degree, it's not quite deep enough, but still, it's way beyond the average ham radio operator's usual depth of analysis of a problem. But there are guys who can take very complicated problems like this, boil it down into simple language that we all can understand. Mel is usually the guy that can do it, so let's see what Mel can do on this one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Highly operated power supply for safety.
Okay, let's see if I got it. This is K2KEY. All right, let's go back and I'll tell you similar things that happened years ago. If you remember the old TV sets, we had lots of hoops in them. Every so often I'd see one that the filament did not light up in the set. Remember, all the tubes were in parallel, and each one was drawing, I don't know, like 600 milliamps of current off the 6.3 winding on a power transformer. And you see all of a sudden the filaments don't light up. You take the, disconnect the power transformer 6.3 volt winding, and you measure it at 6.3. You put it on to the filament, and it's gone. It just drops right down. Now, what's happening there? A lot of people, what they did, instead of, replacing the power transformer, you see a lot of repairs done. They get a separate 6.3 volt, transformer, just 110 to 6.3, and stick it on there. And that was the repair. I mean, if you didn't want to, go through the customer wouldn't go for a power transformer, because of something in the price, so you want to get the repair out any which way. But what was happening to the power transformer? What's happening to that 6.3? The only thing I can think of, because of the heavy current load over it, over a period of time, something may be cooked out in the copper material, the copper windings, Dick. That's the only way I can account for it. Over.
Yeah, an intermittent opening of the winding, where the winding itself is supposed to be, let me pick a number, a tenth of an ohm, and it suddenly becomes 10 ohms. And the voltage drop across the resistance of the winding, a poor contact somewhere inside, can certainly explain that loss of 6.3 and all the filaments going dark. We've still got a bit of a mystery here, though, as you can tell, because we've measured leakage reactants, we've measured voltages in various places. What Joe did do is to put his Simpson meter across the secondary winding of the power transformer that feeds the bridge rectifier under load, and the AC voltage was still there. So the raw AC voltage out of the transformer is being supplied to the bridge rectifier. The bridge rectifier is brand new, it's been replaced. The capacitors are brand new, they've been replaced. And now he's had to replace the choke. And so I've requested that Joe make some measurements of the so-called bad choke to try to find out what happened, because it still measures the right number of ohms across the winding, and he's now put it under higher current and measured the ohms across the winding, and it's right, and he's measured the leakage of the winding to the core. So it's still a bit of a mystery. KC2QIQ, let's see what he's got to say. Go ahead, Glenn, K2LIW.
Okay, I think I have it now. Yeah, the leakage now, when the leakage was measured, I'm assuming that was with a DC meter, I guess, you know, measuring like an ohmmeter to ground. I'm just wondering, have you ever measured the AC impedance or see if there's any leakage? And another thing to look at, too, is